Emily and Henry, my wife and son, are up in Tahoe still, where I was on Friday, some family friend's cabin. Standing there on Friday, out overlooking the lake, one of the most just beautiful sights in the whole world, right? What our spiritual ancestor, Thomas Starr King, called a gem of the divine art. The glittering blue waters embraced by the gray-green mountains. That's what I was looking out on as I listened to Senator Susan Collins explain why she would be voting to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Because my insides were in knots as I listened, and the incongruity of the moment seeming to pull my stomach and my heart in opposite directions. How can the world contain so much beauty and so much pain all at once? Does the moral arc of the universe truly bend towards justice? Now, Reverend Jake Morrill, who's a Unitarian minister out in Tennessee, offers a reflection on a midrash on the Noah story. Midrash are these generations upon generations of commentary on scripture in the Jewish tradition. It's commentary upon commentary upon commentary. And so Jake notes that one midrash says that while some animals ate in the second hour of the night, others ate in the third hour of the day. So you know that in feeding them all, Noah and his family hardly tasted sleep, the midrash says, hardly tasted sleep through the whole storm and the long length of the flood. For month after month, the caregiving, the exhaustion, the whole world soaked through. And I think of the floods in recent weeks and months in the Carolinas, in Nigeria, across the Midwest this week. And I think of the fires, too. This month marking a year since the fires that wreaked havoc across all the communities just to our north. The sense that it could be the new normal, smoky skies up and down the West Coast every summer. We may not know exactly how the science works, but we do know that climate change probably has something to do with it, but also somehow that it's bigger than climate change, that our species' ecological disregard over the past two centuries is finally catching up with us. And it may be our friends, our family, fleeing the fires or the floods this time, or it may not, but either way, we can't help but hear, but say, but think, it's not usually like this. It wasn't like this when I was a kid. This was the worst in so many years. And in all those places, Jake reminds us, there are first responders. In all those places, there are first responders tending to people and animals, even through their exhaustion, when they haven't tasted sleep, and so much has been ruined. And sometimes the first responders wear a uniform, and sometimes the responders are parents or cousins or a neighbor, all acting not only out of duty, but out of compassion, so that those in their care get just what it is they need, the right medicine, the right food, the right way to be heard. In the story, he says, in the story, even before things are anywhere near fully dry, and probably catching his breath from the round-the-clock animal care, Noah sends out a dove who comes back with an olive branch. And it's just a small thing, just a twig, but it means everything. That, after all, ruination isn't how it all ends. That new life was already rising up even before they could see it or would have ever dared hope. The world is ending, and somehow it's still worth working day and night to feed the animals. The world is ending, and somehow it's still worth following the impulse to care. How can the world contain so much pain and beauty all at once? So, eschatology is a theological term for wrestling with the question of the end of the world. Most world religions offer some kind of eschatological vision. That is, vision of the ultimate fate of the world. And often this is referred to as the world to come. The world to come. It's a translation of the Hebrew Ha'alam Haba, which in the Jewish Talmud is described like this. In the world to come, there is no eating, no drinking, no procreation, no business negotiations, no jealousy, no hatred, no competition. Rather, the righteous sit with crowns upon their heads, enjoying the splendor of the divine presence. In Hinduism, similarly, the world to come is imagined as the golden age of Satya Yaga. Described in the Mahabharata like this, there were no rich and no poor. There was no need to labor, because all that people required was obtained by the power of will. The chief virtue was the abandonment of all worldly desires. The Krita Yuga, another name for this golden age, was without disease. There was no lessening with the years. There was no hatred or vanity or evil thought. No sorrow, no fear. All humankind could attain supreme blessedness. This idea of a world to come, of a perfect and unattainable paradise, it's prevalent in so many cultures, and I'm sure you have an image of it in your mind. And for most of us, that image comes from Christianity's idea of the kingdom of heaven. That's the dominant image in our culture. The kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. Whatever that image comes from, whatever cultural source, there's usually two qualities to these worlds to come. The first is that it's another world, not this world. Right? It's another plane of existence. It's not for this lifetime. And the second is that it's for some and not for others. Who is in and who is out of the world to come is a long-standing debate in almost all theological traditions, right? So luckily for us, though, we are the inheritors of the universalist strand of Christianity, which offers clear and, I think, beautiful answers to these questions. Many of you probably know the name universalism. It comes from universal salvation, that all are together. There is no hell. Reverend Mark Morrison Reed talks about an old universalist eschatological image. He says, the last unrepentant sinner being dragged, kicking and screaming, into heaven. Unable to resist the power and love of the Almighty. Historical universalism was called the gospel of God's success. And, you know, while most of us don't think about these things in terms of an anthropomorphic God these days, or heaven as a literal place, this idea of the incredible strength of a universal and powerful love, of a circle of care and compassion that leaves no one out. And this is still central to our faith. Got updated a bit in the 20th century. Universalist minister Gordon McKeeman equipped universalists believe that we are going to end up together in heaven. So, we might as well learn to get along with each other now. There's no separate paradise without the struggle. This is not an esoteric universalism, but a practical one, a one that says that us earthlings, we ultimately share a common fate. And so we're called to a common purpose. Over the past decades, scientists have empirically demonstrated this truth with greater and greater clarity. Our radical interconnectedness is not simply ancient spiritual wisdom. It's awe-inspiring scientific fact. And these universalist ideas, they were an eschatological challenge to a traditional Christian eschatology of an otherworldly kingdom of heaven, reserved for a select few. And they were part of a broader social movement through Christianity that became known as social gospel Christianity, a thread within the tradition that began about a century and a half ago, increased in prominence to the 20th century. The eschatology of social gospel Christianity says it's humans' job to bring about the kingdom of heaven here on earth. Human's job to make it happen. This is the end goal, the vision of the end times, a world made just by the work of human hands. In many ways, our understanding of the call to social justice, our tradition's emphasis on the need to care for this world and make it more equitable, this all comes from that social gospel understanding of eschatology. And while social gospel eschatology has historically been primarily associated with liberal Christianity and the overlapping liberal social movements, labor movements, universal suffrage, strong social safety net, more environmental protections, I think a social gospel eschatology has actually permeated the culture more deeply. Here's what I mean. I think there was once a theological divide, a fundamental worldview level disagreement underlying political discourse that was a debate between those who felt it was human's job to create heaven on earth and those who felt like it was human's job to ensure as many people as possible made it to the real kingdom of heaven coming at the end of time. Like, those are two very different goals. And while that division still exists, I think the theological division animating our politics today may actually be that a majority of folks on all sides have bought into a social gospel eschatology, but with very different visions of what it means to make the kingdom of heaven on earth. Very different visions of what that kingdom of heaven looks like. An intersectional feminist kingdom of heaven, which, of course, we can't even call a kingdom of heaven anymore. The kingdom of heaven, come on. Looks very different than a traditionally conservative kingdom of heaven that does not seek to upend the cultural norms of patriarchy and white supremacy. But there's a limitation. There's a limitation here to this way of thinking, this working towards making the world into our vision of paradise. Because social gospel holds up the vision of a perfect world to come. Even though it's by our hands and here on earth, it can leave us fighting and striving in ways that do not ultimately serve us. Certainly in ways that don't bridge our daunting chasm of cultural division. Right? When we hold on to those separate visions of paradise, it's us and them, the forces of oppression, the forces of the resistance. Michelle Alexander, that celebrated author of The New Jim Crow, she recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. Anybody see that? Just this beautiful corrective to the language of the resistance that sprang up after the election of Donald Trump. In her op-ed, she points out that the moral arc of the universe, she points to it and she says that it is, in fact, those who would hold on to the oppressive structures of patriarchy and white supremacy who are resisting the liberatory river of history. Our work is not to make the world more like our perfect image of the way it should be, but to join that liberatory river, she points out. There's another way of saying it. In UU theologian Rebecca Parker's words, the hoped-for future, that image of the perfect world to come, it perpetually condemns the present. The failure of the world to conform to God's vision of justice and abundance is laid at humanity's feet. We have not worked hard enough, smart enough, been well organized enough, convinced enough people, or corrected the flaws in our approach. That's why we're not there yet. So Parker offers instead a radically realized eschatology. It begins that we affirm that we are already standing on holy ground, she writes. This earth, and none other, is a garden of beauty, a place of life. Neglecting it for some other imagined better place will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. It will make earth a wasteland. There is no land promised to any of us other than the land already given, the world already here. Radically realized eschatology says that flood is part of paradise. says the exhausting work of caring for those animals 24/7, that's part of paradise, too. It says firefighters putting their lives on the line to save homes and communities, that's an appropriate ethical response to living in the beauty of this world, to living in paradise. It says we may not be able to change the immigration system tomorrow, but we can offer care and accompaniment to undocumented immigrants in our community. That's part of living in paradise. Talk to Ann or Linda about that after the service if you want to fill out a survey and get involved in our sanctuary work. Because the only paradise that is to be found, the only paradise that is to be found is the one that is here and now. And this paradise, it contains suffering and struggle right alongside beauty and delight. Pain and beauty, struggle and joy are integral parts of our paradise. Radically realized eschatology, it's about a world to come that is already here and now. The arc of the moral universe is long, much longer than any election cycle or any presidency, much longer than our lifetimes, much longer even than any life of any country or institution. I even imagine it must be infinitely long. No stopping point. No destination to arrive at, but its justice-shaped bent is a part of this paradise, here and now. So my teacher, Rebecca, she tells a story of a bus ride up in the Ansel Adams wilderness in the Sierra Nevadas. She's getting to know her seatmate on this bus ride, the friend of a family member. He said that he'd been raised Catholic, she writes, and that his wife was the daughter of a Methodist minister. Church was important to him. "I can't believe all the doctrines," he said. "I was never comfortable with the bloody crucifix hanging over the altar. I couldn't understand why we would be worshiping. But I learned a way of life from the church that I have not rejected." "And what is that way of life?" Rebecca asked him. "Oh, it simply said, love your neighbor as yourself. Try to help, not harm. Do what you can to make a difference." He went on, we foster care. We do foster care for kids. He said it was heartbreaking to see some of the violence, abuse, deprivation that these children have experienced. But he and his wife welcomed them into their home and did what they could. "Not even love can repair the damage sometimes," he said. "Not even love can repair the damage sometimes." He asked what book topic I was working on, Rebecca writes, and I answered paradise. "Paradise," he mused, and he looked out the window of the bus for a few moments at the bright sky, the deep green pine forests, the alpine meadows coming into view and rising above them, the sharp peaks of the minarets. "Do you mean paradise like where we are right now?" "Yes," Rebecca said, "like where we are right now." She writes, "We both gazed out the window for a few moments, breathing the pungent fresh air. This is enough," he said. "You know that because you help kids," she said. A cloud of thoughtfulness passed over his face. "Yes," he replied, "that's right." And she ends the story with this thought: we come to know this world as paradise when our hearts and souls are reborn through the arduous and tender task of living rightly with one another. Generosity and mutual care are the pathways into knowing that paradise is here and now. This way of living is not utopian. It does not spring from imagination for a better world, but from a profound embrace of this world. It brings hope home to today, to this moment, and its possibilities for faithful love. "Not even love can repair the damage sometimes," he said, and yet his friend and his wife, they still show up with their love. Homes and lives and souls can cannot always be repaired, not even by the greatest love, yet the act of seeing and loving these broken places still matters. Truth cannot always be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Heartbreaking stories will be told and ignored. Families will be caught in the crossfire of political battles. Grave injustices will come to pass. Yet, living in this paradise, bearing witness to all this suffering, we must still grieve and lament because we love. Let the waters of the world, of Lake Tahoe, of the Pacific Ocean, let them echo with grandeur my own tears as I released my knotted insides, this pain, this grief. This too is part of paradise here and now. Loving these broken places still matters. Not to make them better for tomorrow. Not to make them better for tomorrow, but for the beauty of loving the world, even in its brokenness. Perhaps especially in its brokenness today. So may we fall in love with this world again and again. Fall in love with this here and now, with all our imperfect institutions and leaders. This here and now where we're preparing the next generation to live more gently on the planet. This here and now where we are caring for children, both our own and others who do not have homes or families. This here and now, even with no path, no clear path through our country's bitter division in sight. This here and now where we are welcoming the stranger and providing sanctuary for those in need. May we fall in love with this world again.